Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, and to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host and co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you each and every Saturday evening for education, for fun, and for entertainment. And this evening is no different. We have a very esteemed guest. And before I welcome her in, I'd just like to make a couple of brief announcements, and then I'll bring in Delilah. Thank you, first of all, my national audience, for being here. I always appreciate it. And please do remember that our show, if you can't tune in from 5 to 6 Eastern Time, is always available on our archives anytime, anywhere. And we have a blog post as well after the show. Just want to make a really quick announcement that in a couple of weeks we're coming up upon the second-year anniversary of Shattered Lives radio broadcast, and that indeed is a benchmark for me and something that we're very proud of. So we're planning something special in the future. Also looking into the Parents of Murdered Children Conference. And don't forget that I have my new victim impact writing service that we are starting. If there are any crime victims out there that would like to procure my services, please do talk to Delilah. And so without further ado, I'll bring in my co-host, my PR manager, and compassionate friend to all crime victims, Delilah Jones. Good evening. I'm so glad to have you with me. How are you tonight?
Hi, Donna. I'm doing great. And as always, every Saturday afternoon, here we are. And
yes,
once again, you know, we have, you know, just an amazing guest, someone that I personally have looked up to for quite some time and followed her work. And I'm just thrilled to death to be able to have her on with us today.
Yeah, well, I guess I have connections, huh? I'm really thrilled to have her on as well. So without further ado, Ann Seymour is a very accomplished woman. She has a background in social work, corrections, and public administration. She has had over 30 years of experience in advocacy. She's based out of the Washington, D.C. area right now as a consultant, a policy analyst, and has worked for many of the best advocacy organizations in the country and has received numerous awards. And her areas of expertise are very vast as well. But suffice it to say that none of this has really gone through her head. I've had the pleasure to speak with her a few times, and I found her to be very down-to-earth. And I think that she is the heartbeat of crime victim advocacy, and she has her hand on the pulse of many, many issues that we are interested in. So, Ann Seymour, thank you so much for being with us on Shattered Lives. It's such a pleasure to have you this evening. Welcome.
Thank you, Donna and Delilah, and it's just an honor for me to be with you, and congratulations on your two-year anniversary. That in itself is just a wonderful accomplishment that you're able to nationally put out information about crime victims' rights and needs. I salute you for that.
Well, thank you. I definitely view that as a compliment. And, yes, it is a labor of love, but on the other hand, it also keeps us out of trouble on Saturday evenings, I guess you could say, you know.
Yeah.
And right, Delilah? Right? And
exactly.
It does. And we've had many adventures, and we're looking forward to that anniversary show. But, you know, Ann, there's so many avenues we could go down this evening, and 1 hour will just not do us justice. So I'm going to ask you, with all my national witnesses, perhaps if we could continue the conversation, because I know there will be many other things to talk about maybe in the future. To have you on for a second time because you're so knowledgeable. But, you know, you do a lot with respect to policy work, and you've done direct service. You have vast areas of background and expertise. And I, before we get into the meat of the matter, I just wondered, what in your experience in all these years of working on behalf of crime victims in one way or another, what is the difference between doing what you're doing now and, you know, essentially changing policy and having your hand on the pulse of what's happening and trying to keep up versus being kind of the person in the trenches doing direct service crime victim advocacy? And have you done both, and you know, how did that evolve to what you're doing now? What are the differences? Do you like what you're doing now most of all?
Well, I've always worked for national organizations for Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and then what's now the National Center for Victims of Crime, and also Justice Solutions. But throughout my 30-some years career, I'm giving away my age here, I mean, my heart is with direct services, and I still do a lot of personal advocacy for individual crime victims, usually ones who have, you know, gone through a lot of legal advice and counselors and advocates, and so they're usually kind of complex cases. And I do most of my work over the phone because I do work nationally in all 50 states. But, you know, I think the difference between now and when I began is a big one. And I know you like music, so I'll quote Bob Dylan, who said, you know, when you've got nothing, you've got nothing to lose. And that's how it was when I began in the victim assistance field in 1984. There were very few rights and almost no services for crime victims. And that, of course, has changed dramatically. Today there's over 10,000 amazing programs in all 50 states around the country and increasingly around the world. And I also think a really big difference is that today we're not only talking about crime victim issues, but I really believe in my heart that everybody is or knows a victim of crime. And mm-hmm. crime is a lot more personal than it was when I began because we're talking about it, and personal relationships are affected by crime. So whether it's your family member or your neighbor or a coworker, you know, we all are or know somebody. And that makes it, I think, unique. I think it makes it horrible that we have so many people who are victimized. But the silver lining is that it really does create awareness of victims' needs and services.
Right. Well, and don't you think social media and the internet have exploded with information? And I think a lot of the public that just maybe had their head in the sand or weren't aware of what was going on in their own backyard sometimes, and especially nationally and globally, are now being made aware, and they're seeing that people in their community are affected by crime, whether it's missing persons, human trafficking, domestic violence. It goes on and on and on. So I think, you know, the silver lining to the internet and cyberspace has been that it's given us the ability to get that information out quicker and to reach more people.
Well, I will tell you, you are so right about that. And, you know, I know the internet is a blessing and a curse. Of course, it's created a venue for a lot of more crimes to be committed, but it's also created an amazing venue, especially through social media, for victims to speak out, for victims to seek assistance. And I think one of the really cool things that I'm super proud of is victims getting literally virtual support through virtual support groups, being able to talk confidentially to a rape crisis counselor through RAIN, where they can actually, you know, either go online or do it through social media venues, where they are able to access services that before would have been a lot more difficult for them to even identify, much less, you know, benefit from. So I think it's been a bonus to our field. And, you know, I've always said the power of the personal story is the absolute driving force behind our field for survivors who are willing to speak out with no shame, with no blame, to admit that they have been victimized and to seek justice and to be able to, as many of them have said, I just don't want anyone else to have to go through what I went through. And social media has been amazing for that. And in my job, you know, through my listserv, but also through a lot of social media, I'm able to put out information before that, you know, we would send out by snail mail. And I remember when faxes came along, we were so excited about that. And now it's a press of a button where we can disseminate information that can literally go around the world. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to be connected internationally as well, you know, to be able to know what's going on in the Congo and with the European Union. And it's very exciting. It's an incredible opportunity for our field.
Yes, it certainly is. The reach is just amazing. I remember being at a conference a couple years ago with Mark Klass and him telling the fact that with his daughter Polly, they were still at the folding flyers and licking envelope stage, and that was the beginning 90s. And so you see just an incredible growth in even that short amount of time. So, I totally agree with you. So it is a help and a hindrance. And we're going to get into the hindrance aspect of it with regard to talking about the media and all. But I wondered maybe the other topic that we want to try and tackle a bit is crisis response. With regard to, as we were talking on the phone, our last conversation, it just seems society seems to have exploded with, you know, massacres in terms of, you know, indiscriminate people being killed. You know, it's no longer a one-to-one interpersonal crime. And even in my state, there just seems to be so many links to those types of things happening. So I wondered, could we maybe define the parameters of crisis response? And I know that when we talked, the beginnings of it came out of the Edmond, Oklahoma post office massacre with Patrick Sherrill. And so would you like to expound upon that a bit?
Yeah, that was in my very nascent days as a victim advocate. I was living in Texas, and so Edmond, Oklahoma was not that far away. And this man went into the post office. He was a disgruntled employee, which we hear a lot about that now as well, and just went in with the intent of killing and injuring as many people as he could. And, you know, that wasn't the first time it happened. I remember, you know, back in the 70s, there was the massacre at University of Texas at Austin. But this was the first time that our field sort of rose up in unison with leadership from Dr. Marlene Young and John Stein were at the National Organization for Victim Assistance. And
right.
They got a call from the Attorney General at the time was Mike Turpin, an amazing victim advocate. And he called them and said, we need help. And so they sent in a team of advocates, and this was 1986, to respond to the surviving family members of those who were killed, and there were also a lot of people who were injured, not to mention, you know, the folks who witnessed it, and also we have to really be thinking about the crisis responders. And so out of that, they developed the very initial crisis response protocols that, I mean, it's interesting today, they have become much more precise depending on the type of mass crisis that occurs, and they have really done an amazing job of being able to help victims, not just at the scene of the mass crisis, but in the short term and certainly the long term. As you all know, this is something that people just don't recover from. And, you know, when I think about Edmond, Oklahoma, and shortly thereafter in Oklahoma, the bombing and murders at the Murrah Federal Building, you know, I still work with victims from that, and that was in 1994. And so you know, today I think there's a really good protocol for not just assisting victims, but, you know, more sensitive ways to do death notification, helping victims to deal with the news media and being able to kind of forecast what their long-term experiences might be and identify and meet their needs. And that has been, you know, a blessing and a curse. The curse is that we have so many mass violence events, and the blessing is that we have so many people around the country who are trained to respond to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and is part of that, is that coming out of Washington, D.C. in terms of setting those protocols? Is it coming from the federal government, or is it coming from nonprofits, or is it coming from the is it a collaboration of all of the types of people that you work with, and then the policies are set from there?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question, Donna. I mean, what happens now with mass crisis response is that, you know, every community is required to have a crisis response plan. And those mm-hmm. usually focus on, you know, securing the area and doing the law enforcement and investigation response. What we do is, I think, a little bit different, and it comes from local, state, national, you know, private organizations, governments. It's an incredible, not a collaboration because it's permanent. It's a partnership that we have in virtually every state, where people immediately come together and they know what to do. And we've seen a lot of leadership from the U.S. Department of Justice. We have an Attorney General, Eric Holder, who I will tell you, when he was the U.S. attorney here in Washington, D.C., you know, one of the first things he did was really get his victim assistance program going. And so he sort of gets the whole concept of victim services. And so there's been great leadership from his department. But I also, you know, I want to credit, and I can speak personally because of the shootings we had at the Navy Yard here in September. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, it was the Mayor's Office of Victim Services, and we have a victim assistance network, which is all community-based and system-based service providers. You know, we got the text, and the Navy Yard is a block away from my house. I could not drive or metro there. Everything was shut down. I had to jog down to National Stadium, who were kind enough to open up their facility for us. And, I mean, throughout the day, we ended up having, you know, the FBI, the MPD, our local police department, a lot of community-based victim services and mental health providers. Later in the day, Navy, chaplains, it was a mix of Department of Defense and the feds and local and the mayor. And I know it sounds very mixed up and complex, and when we look back on that day, in some ways it was, but it all came together. And so we were able to, you know, at the end of that day, we had pretty close to 3,000 people who came through our facility. A lot of them had been in lockdown for, you know, 10 and 12 hours. Many of them didn't have their keys, didn't have Metro cards. So, you know, Metro opened up free transportation. The ride service Uber gave free rides to people who lived 60 miles away and didn't have their car keys. National Stadium provided us with incredible, like the best buffet I've ever been to in my life. They rolled out the food. They canceled their ball game. This doesn't sound like a big deal, but we had a lot of traumatized people, and the Nationals were practicing thinking they were playing that night before they canceled the game. And I asked the manager, would you mind if we had some people just go and watch the game? And they said, of course. And so these people got to actually go and sit, like, in the front row and, you know, watch the baseball team, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but that day it was. And
well, it was a distraction.
It was, it just was very comforting to a lot of people. We had the American Red Cross show up with, you know, blankets because it was cold. And so all of this came together. And as a result, we've done a number of debriefings, and an after-action report is coming. And so, you know, every time this happens, and I want to say from Edmonds, Oklahoma to today, including September 11th, every time we have a mass crisis response, we all get together and say, you know, we did our best, what can we do better? And so that's the process we're going through now, as we did after the horrible tragedy of September 11th, which affected not just communities but our nation as a whole, to be able to, you know, develop lessons learned and to be able to do the work that we do better. And I have to tell you, I've been involved in a number of these, and it's among my most important work, but also doing the, you know, the processing afterwards. And I guess that's what I love about our field. We always say, how can we do it better? And that's kind of the blessing of our field, is that we're always looking to better serve victims and to make sure we really know what their needs are in crisis and in the aftermath of crisis.
Well, it sounds like it all came together like a ballet, the way you described it. Everyone was, you know, all of the protocols dovetailed. And, you know, as a matter of fact, you may have known this already, but when the D.C. shooter was doing his deed was the week of the NOVA conference in Ohio. So how about that? I was there in Ohio at the conference, and we saw that on TV and all. So it's just amazing that so many of these people could be mobilized and coordinated to do what you need to do, and to give people a little bit of a sense of control and comfort and in chaos, And I don't know, how is it that if you have so many jurisdictions in, how do they work together? Do you just practice so much that you know that I do this piece and so-and-so does that piece or whatever?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, in D.C. it was unique because the site was a military base, and we thought there was an active shooter for a very long time, and it really depends on the type of crisis. I just learned yesterday at a debriefing that about certain types of cases that the FBI would take the lead on versus the U.S. attorney, and at the Navy Yard there was a lot we did not know until much later in the day. And so we went, our motto, and I laugh at it now, but our motto was no job too small. I mean, I went into the Nat Stadium, there was the parking lot, and the bathroom needed to be cleaned, and we needed toilet paper and paper towels, and then we needed clipboards. And so I texted my neighbors, and they went to the local CVS and showed up with everything we needed. And so it wasn't just the victim. I enlisted my neighbors to help out.
So to me that's the most amazing thing. If you reach out into the community, all you have to do is ask, and everything you need is provided. And, the other thing that I think is important to put out there is there's no piece of the puzzle that's too small. Everybody gets together for the common good, so to speak, and everybody plays a part. And every part is so important that if this person, no matter how small they might think their little job is, if they don't show up, then things just don't go as well. And I have to applaud all of those worker bees out there or people who volunteer their time and give of themselves. And maybe they don't think they're doing enough, but they're doing all they can do, and that's what's important.
Well, you're so right. I want you to think about in the aftermath of Sandy Hook, up where you live, that the outpouring of support and donations and stuffed animals. I mean, people across the country just want to help. Everyone was so touched by that tragedy because of the number of young children
that perished.
The heroics of the principal and the teachers, and I think people were really profoundly touched by that. As they were, D.C., we have a lot of military folks. We have the same outpouring of support, and you make a really good point, Delilah, and that is that every little bit helps, and people, I think, feel good. They feel helpless when something like this happens, and being able to help gives us a sense of control over a life that seems out of control. When you can have something so devastating happen, it really helps people make sense of the senseless. And I know that sounds trite, but that is what happens. And it's a really important aspect of this. And that's why, in answer to your early question, it's the federal government, but it was my neighbors too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the toilet paper. It was the feds, but it was the person that brought the toilet paper, which is so important as well. And it's so right. I was thinking in the back of my mind, I wish they had had that kind of coordination with, like, Hurricane Katrina, because it seemed like just the opposite of what you were describing with what happened with the Navy Yard incident. So I don't know. I guess it just depends on who's in charge at the top at the time and delegates, let's set this protocol, down and go from there. But,
After Katrina, there was a lot of assessment that went on after Katrina so that we would not make the same mistakes that we did then. And hopefully, we always talk about lessons learned, and I'm like, are they really learned? Because I don't want to have something like that, to have a really fractured response happen again. And, fortunately for us in September, it was fairly well organized, and lots of people came together, and it did seem to work. But we're big about you know, as I keep saying, assessing and improving, assessing and improving. That's what we're about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, when I was reading about Edmond, Oklahoma, in fact, I had done a extensive blog on all of these postal shootings. And one thing that struck me is that, you know, when you try to go back and analyze who these shooters are, and in fact, when you mentioned Sandy Hook, the committee that Governor Malloy has put together in order to try to understand and analyze, they still, after all of these, you know, months and over a year, I mean, a law enforcement report is a very different thing than a psychiatric report. So they're employing the help of Adam Lanza's father and getting releases in order to try and get more information so that we can help other people with mental illness. But one thing that did strike me when I was reading about Patrick Sherrill, too, is that it seems, and I wonder, Ian, my question would be, is this the way it is? You talk to some people and they say, oh, he was the greatest guy. He used to come over and mow my lawn for nothing, and he did this and he did that. And then somebody else would say, well, he was very strange. He didn't talk to anybody. He was very reclusive. He had strange habits. So these kinds of shooters are typically not well understood as a person. You can't really get your arms around who they are and what they're about until it's too late. Does that seem to be, you know, happening with all of these people who are responsible for these mass shootings?
Well, I can't speak for all of them, but I was just yesterday at the National Sheriff's Association conference was in town, and in one of my sessions, the sheriffs were talking about the percentage of the inmates in jail, and, you know, jail is a short-term thing in most states, the percentage of those who are mentally ill is through the roof. I mean, one of our top mental health providers in the country is our jails and our departments of corrections. And that is, you know, absolutely, I think, a challenge that we have to face in terms of prevention is doing much more preventive work regarding people with mental illnesses who are out in the community to be able to have them access services. But I also think, I mean, I'm really aging myself, but I'll take you back to, you know, a very serious offender who was described by the media as being handsome, in college. He was a Republican Party volunteer, and that was Ted Bundy. I mean, everyone, you know, I mean, that was why I got involved in victims and media, because they spent so much time talking about, you know, him and how, you know, what a surprise it was. And then they described, I will never forget, one of his victims, her nude frozen body was found in a snowbank. And that was what they said about his victim. And yet they, you know, I don't know how much ink went to his, you know, nature and his background that made him sound like someone that, you know, at that time I would have dated. He sounded fabulous. And I think that's part of the problem, is that people have different perceptions, and people who are mentally ill, who are psychotic, they can come across as very different personalities, if you know what I'm saying. And so it's really hard sometimes to predict who's going to be the person who does, you know, the serial crimes or the mass violence crimes. But, when you mentioned Sandy Hook, and I would also point to Aurora, we are looking at the offenders in that case, and we're looking at all the signs that were there that, you know, perhaps if we had been more diligent, and I'm not sure who we is, but a lot of it is, you know, mental health, to be able to determine that these people need help. They need help. In some cases, they really need intensive help, and they need to not be in society until they get that help. So sorry, I'm blabbing on and on. I could go on that forever.
No, absolutely. You're right. And those are the issues that we're grappling with here. And it's far beyond the issue of, you know, your First Amendment rights to carry guns. I mean, really the issue is the mental health issue when it comes down to it. And go ahead, Delilah.
I'm sorry, Donna. Don't you think... I know it was a horrible, horrible system that we had many, many years ago with insane asylums and mental health. A lot of the, you know, when they shut that whole system down, where did all these people go? They went to the streets. And how can we fix that? I mean, how can we make it a better system to where these people are not out on the streets? Now we have the homeless, and we have, you know, the criminals that are now going to jail to get mental health resources. So it doesn't make sense if we're reacting to the problems that are created by those with mental health issues rather than working on the preventative side of it.
I can't agree with you more. We can continue to spend money on law enforcement, victim assistance, and crisis response, or we can wisely spend money on community-based intervention with people with mental illness. Most people with mental illness with treatment can and should be in our communities, except for those with, you know, serious and coexisting mental illnesses. Most of them with treatment can be there, but, you know, if someone is out in the community and refusing to take their medication and having psychotic episodes, that does pose a risk. But, you know, I want to be very clear, because I do work with a lot of folks who work with mentally ill offenders with treatment, and those who are already offenders with good supervision, you know, behavior can be contained. It's mm-hmm. just a matter of saying that we need to invest our limited, every state except North Dakota is broke now, our limited dollars on community-based interventions. And also, I mean, my eyes were really opened yesterday at the National Sheriff's Association that we ought to be doing as much as we can when we have these people, even for a short time in jail, to do really good mental health assessments, and also to look at people's trauma history. I mean, there's all kinds of issues related to folks who've had trauma and victimization in their background, to be able to assess not just, you know, mental illness and depression and schizophrenia, but, you know, some of the causes of that are some really horrible, horrible backgrounds. And unfortunately, as you both know, many of them involve past trauma. So, you know, that's the interesting thing is that I do work a lot with correctional agencies. I do work a lot with mental health professionals. We have a lot of folks working with, you know, for example, women who are incarcerated. You know, we're finally doing assessments that look at not just that they're in prison, but their backgrounds that I'm not going to say caused them to commit crimes, but they're correlating factors, and very often it is past victimization and trauma.
Right, or, you know, addictions of some type. And you know what it sounds like to me? It almost sounds like wherever they may end up, whether it's a, you know, short-term situation in a jail versus a prison or some type of institutionalization, we're almost turning to a one-stop shopping society. Look at when we go to buy our groceries, there's also the pharmacy in there, there's also the this and that. So it almost lends itself to we should have be able to plug in all of these resources so that we can nip this kind of behavior in the bud and get to the root of it, or at least, like you say, control the person's illness such that it wouldn't get out of hand and, you know, cause another incident of mass proportion.
And that is, again, I am reflecting back to your original question, a really big difference between when I began over 30 years ago and today. I mean, in 1984, I wouldn't be in the same room with defense attorneys. I thought people who worked with offenders had cooties, and now I'm in the thick of them. I work on corrections reform. I work mm-hmm. to help. I'm on the Prison Rape Review Board for the Justice Department. There's so much crossover between and among crime victims and offenders, and then the mental health issues. And I'm so glad you brought up addiction, because alcohol and other drugs are a bane in terms of being correlating factors with criminal activity, and also, you know, for victims as a coping mechanism. So the crossovers are amazing, and I have changed from a kind of a, you know, hard victim advocate to someone who, you know, my door is open to anyone who wants to help fix this. I mean, my door is wide open.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. I think that's the way we all have to be. And, you know, the drawing those boundaries to say, like, you're in the courtroom, okay, that's the defense side and this is the prosecution side and never the twain shall meet. I've seen some amazing crossovers, even during trials when I did court escorting, where you'd never think that someone from the, you know, offending side would come over and try to to outreach to the victim, and it's very touching in its own way. I mean, except for the person that actually offended, the family is not really responsible for what was done, and they're grieving and they're in pain just like we are as victims.
Yeah, and I have to be honest with you. In my extended family, I have people who are victims and people who have been incarcerated. And, mm-hmm. I used to think, Donna and Delilah, that I was so unique and unusual. And I remember about 5 years ago, I think it might have been at a NOVA conference, I sort of brought it up at a session I was teaching, and a lot of people raised their hands and said, "Sister, I'm in the same boat." I mean, so it's not that unusual that people fall, they have families and they have social circles where they have both criminals and victims and survivors. And, again, there's so much correlation between the two. And I only wish it hadn't taken me 20 years to figure it out because, my first 10 years as an advocate, I was very narrow-minded. And I think that's been a really important thing, not just in my personal psyche, but in how I approach victim assistance, because I look at things so much more holistically than I ever did before.
Holistically, yeah. And I mean, it sounds like that comes from experience because, here are my defined roles. This is my job and never the twain shall meet kind of thing. And it's not like that anyway. Our society is all about blending, I think, for good or for bad. I don't know. But with regard to that, I wondered if maybe we could address some of the things with regard to just how we are getting the information and with respect to how crime victims have been treated historically once there is a tragedy that happens in the family. And, it used to be this newspaper print and your local three-station network that you had to worry about in terms of, am I going to be approached by them? But it's a whole different can of worms now, Ian, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I sort of forced myself to learn about social media. I was very late to it because I heard a lot from victims who were not getting appropriate responses through social media or when you go online to read a newspaper article about a victim, anybody can comment. And it's some of the comments that people put out there, of course, I'm all for free speech, are incredibly hurtful to victims. And so I think that has really changed. And I remember back in 1986, after a very large, multiple victim case, I got so upset. It was involving a lot of child victims about how the victims were treated that a colleague of mine, Linda Lawrence, and I sat. I remember we were in Southern California working on the case, and we just sat down and said, we've got to come up with what eventually became victims' rights in the media, which they aren't really rights, but they're things about how the media should treat victims so that it's a little bit more fair and letting victims know that they have control over, to some degree, how the media treat them. And, I want you to think about how, someone is traumatized. You have been sexually assaulted or battered or your child has been murdered, and the media show up, and you can't even think through the fog, and someone asks you for an interview, and you say, yeah, and all of a sudden, you might find yourself in some murky waters. And so there's been a whole kind of subfield within our field that I've been very involved in is really helping victims understand how the news media work and increasingly, as you say, how the social media work and also really the role of victim advocates in helping victims in the aftermath of crime, especially, a lot of those who go through criminal trials, which are covered by the media. Letting them know that they have privacy rights and letting them know that they can have a funeral without the media being there and that they don't have to answer questions. And I say all this with the caveat that I think most media are really, really responsible in covering crime and victimization, but there are a few bad apples that spoil the crop, and we now have 24-hour media and social media layer on top of that. And so it becomes a little bit more complex. It becomes very challenging for victims. And I can tell you as an advocate, a lot of my support work with victims, it remains you know, how the media covered their crime.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what, in if someone approaches you in the very acute phases, you know, right away, and it, whether it's, you know, it might be high profile for that particular town or city or whatnot, what are some of the most common mistakes that a victim may make in terms of agreeing, or on the other side of the coin, what if the family feels, oh, they're not paying attention to this, so we have to promote this, so they might contact, you know, your local TV station, and oh my goodness, they're getting into a quagmire here in terms of, you know, they don't know what they're getting into. So what are some of the pitfalls that you know, our listening audience can take heed of to try to avoid? I mean, should you accept, you know, certain kinds of invitations over others, or does it depend on the timing or whatnot?
You know, that's a very good question, but every victim is unique and every case is unique, and I think my best advice is to have a victim advocate, whether it's a community-based program or a law enforcement or prosecutor probation-based program, someone who can be with you and help you figure it out. I will tell you the other thing, my best advice to victims and to advocates, and we've trained gazillions across the country, is to put everything in writing for victims. You know, years ago, I started training people to get a bright red folder where everything they get from law enforcement, media requests, victim advocacy, you know, defense counsel wanting to talk to them, they put everything in a file so that they have it in an organized place. I think that's really, really important. And mm-hmm. for victims and the media, I think it's having an advocate or a trusted, it could be a family member, a friend, a clergy member, someone who can speak on behalf of the survivor or the family so that the word can get out. And you make a good point. I mean, there are so many cases that, you know, should be more high profile than they are. And sometimes it's based on where you live or your gender or the color of your skin that, you know, we don't always pay attention to crime. And even in cases when it's a high profile crime, I really encourage victims to have someone who can guide them through the process. And your listeners can go to justicesolutions.org, and we have developed two guidebooks. One is sort of been updated over the years of my work for victim advocates and victims. And the other one, it's the first time we ever did this, we wrote a guidebook for journalists that helped them understand, you know, a little bit about what it's like to be a victim and ways they can approach victims in a much more sensitive manner to help them get, you know, a quotation or a good story. And I think if journalists and if advocates and survivors all read these guidebooks, it empowers them with information to have a sense of the direction that they want to go. And for victims, I will tell you, I'm preaching to the choir again, but the power and control that was taken away from them when they were victimized can be regained by, you know, making good, informed choices and decisions in terms of dealing with the media and everything else in their case as well. And the last thing I would say, if there is a criminal case, and it took me a long time to figure this out, you've got to work with your prosecutor. If the judge issues a gag order, there's a really good reason, and that means that the victim should not be speaking. And if the victim chooses to speak, which is their right, they may end up having a change of venue, which means they have to travel 60 or 100 miles to the trial. And so, you know, every decision, I think, has a consequence, and we just need to make folks aware of that.
All very good practical advice. And what about the situation in which, and this occurs very often, in that, you know, there's an active case going on, but yet law enforcement takes the stance that there is no comment to be offered because it's an active case, and, you know, and in turn they don't share any kind of information with the family, and oftentimes the family gets so frustrated by that they may turn around and do something that's not in their best interest. How do you deal with that?
I think a big part of that is training law enforcement, which, again, I was at the National Sheriff yesterday. I hate to keep bringing that up.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important to train law enforcement and really create, and again, partnerships that are permanent with victim advocates so that, you know, I know very often, especially with active investigations, there is very limited information. What they can do is daily or every other day meet with the victim and tell them we still can't give you this information, but as soon as we can, it will be on your plate. And the other thing is not just saying we can't give you this information, but saying that it is an active investigation and the information we're gathering is evidence in the case and we cannot share it with you until we have gone through the investigation. If I heard that from a cop, I would get it. I would say, okay, they're keeping in touch with me. They're okay. Telling me every day that they're still, you know, I'm learning that they're working hard on the case. And it gives victims a greater understanding of why they can't have access to that information. An advocate is another, I don't want to say a tool, but a great resource to be able to talk to a detective and say, is there anything, any little bone we can toss me that I can share with the victim? And very often there is information. And, you know, I think the information, Donna and Delight, it goes both ways. I mean, the victims are very often witnesses. And so, you know, hopefully there are open communications. And everyone realizes, and they don't always, that we're working on the same goal, and that is to protect the victim, to catch the perpetrator, and prevent this from happening again. It's just the way we communicate with each other doesn't always convey messages. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone is very well-intentioned, but then again, too, it depends on the jurisdiction, and if something happens in a small podunk town, law enforcement may not be as experienced in handling that kind of a case, and they don't, in turn, not know how to effectively deal with victims as well. It kind of carries over.
Yeah, and that, you know, I know we started talking a little bit about the Internet and social media, but I will tell you the National Law Enforcement Associations and certainly all the National Victim Associations, we have online and web-based trainings on all of these topics that we're talking about, and it's so easy to access information, and many of them have CEUs available, so you can actually, you know, count it as professional training, because every criminal justice and law enforcement officer needs to have, you know, CEU trainings throughout the year. And I think it's really important that people be aware of all of the resources that are there that can help them improve how they not just respond to victims, but, you know, investigate cases and essentially or ultimately prevent crime from occurring in the first place. And so just being aware that, because of the Internet and because no one has funding for training anymore, we need to we need to be looking online for these resources and also commit. I mean, I will say, you know, I work so closely with law enforcement and with corrections. They want to do right by victims. And even if you're in a small rural town, I mean, that's where you don't get the on-site education, and you can be seeking it through online venues. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to put that little nugget out, because there are rich resources if people are willing to educate themselves.
Are there any resources in particular that come to mind that you think are just stellar and maybe some of our audience should know about it, whether it's
I'll give you a couple of the National Sheriff's Association and International Association of Chiefs of Police, that's IACP.org and NSA.org, they've got really incredible victims committees, and they put out a lot of resources on, you know, improving work with crime victims. If you look at our federal government, www.ovc.gov is the Office for Victims of Crime, and literally any type of crime victimization and response, whether it's law enforcement, you know, the justice system or corrections, there's resources there for them. And then within corrections, there are groups such as I work very closely with APPA, American Probation and Parole Association, and they have done immense amount of training curricula to help probation and parole officers more effectively respond to victims. And these are people who are supervising offenders in the community. And as we said earlier, some of these offenders are mentally ill or have addiction issues. we want to make sure, and they're so happy to work with us, that they are aware of victims' rights and needs as they go through the corrections process. So, I mean, you could literally use any search engine and do victims, corrections, victims, jails. It'll take you to where you need to go for more information. I mean, that's one of the great sources of pride in my life, is that there's a lot of good stuff out there.
And you don't necessarily have to have the latest and greatest computer equipment to participate in a webinar, because they would say, oh, well, our department doesn't have money to upgrade our systems. I mean, you can, you know, it doesn't take a lot to participate in a webinar, correct?
It does not take a lot. It just takes a little bit of software that's free. But the other thing is that, I'm glad to have the chance to say this, a lot of folks are moving to online training, which is self-guided training. So you could go to any of those websites and in the search, within the website, search for online training. And you can actually do self-guided training that has pre-tests and post-tests, that takes you through a lot of learning activities, you know, and slides, that you're able to measure the knowledge that you gain by the time you go through a, you know, a two-hour up to a 16-hour curriculum. It's pretty amazing. And that just requires, you could have any old crappy computer and oh, sorry, I just said a bad word. You could have any old computer and still be able to access really, really good quality training.
Well, yeah, that's good. And especially for those of us like me that are low-tech, then I guess there is hope. And, you know, I work for state government, and our budgets are really very much of a shoestring, so they're always looking to, to save money, even on a toilet paper, and that's the truth.
Yeah. No, but everyone is broke, and we're so cognizant of that. And again, that's one of the benefits that Delilah was saying earlier about technology. One of the blessings is that we're able to, you know, instead of doing national conferences or regional workshops, we're able to put stuff online. We're able to do national webinars that, you know, hundreds or thousands of people can join in one training at absolutely no cost to them. And I would encourage people to be aware of that.
Yeah, and hope that there's a minimum of technical difficulties getting all those people on the same, because sometimes that happens too. But, you know, that whoever the webmaster is or who's in charge, you know, they can, you know, fix all the glitches. But, you know, we've got about 7 minutes or so, and I want to leave some time for you. Every single year that I've known, you know, for the past 32 years since my dad was murdered, there is a National Crime Victims' Rights Week that occurs in April, correct, Anne? And
that
I
is correct.
Special things to tell us about that, since you're in the thick of things in Washington, D.C., and NOVA's there, and National Crime Victims' Rights Center, and you're just right there where it all happens.
Well, you know, I really do love the fact that every year we choose a week. It was started by President Ronald Reagan in 1981. Right. It's National Crime Victims' Rights Week, and this year it's April 6th to 12th. And the theme is a good one. It's 30 years, restoring the balance of justice. And I think one of the intentions of this theme is to focus on the Crime Victims Fund. And I think a lot of people aren't aware that many crime victims' rights and services throughout the country are supported by fines and fees that are collected by U.S. attorneys and FBI officers who investigate federal crimes. When there's a conviction in a federal crime, in many of these cases, the offenders are ordered to pay a fine into what's called the Crime Victims Fund. This could be a $50 fine, or it could be a $600 million fine. When you hear about those giant fines, whenever I hear about a giant fine in the media, I'm like, oh, I email my friend Steve Doreen at the National VOCA Association and says, does that go into VOCA? And the important thing about this year is honoring VOCA and U.S. attorneys and the FBI folks who contribute to it. From 1985 to 2013, over $20 billion, that's billion dollars, in non-taxpayer in non-taxpayer money has been deposited into the fund. And the fund every year goes to support, when you think about your local rape crisis centers, and you think about your local domestic violence programs and homicide support groups, It also pays for crime victims' compensation that helps victims recover some of the pecuniary losses resulting from their crime. It pays for the federal victim notification system. The FBI and U.S. Attorney all have victim witness specialists. It's all paid by convicted federal offenders. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to shed a light on this because my U.S. Attorney and FBI here in D.C., they're my unsung heroes because their work has just contributed to millions of dollars just from my district in D.C. into the Crime Victims Fund. And the impact of that is, you know, many victim assistance programs receive VOCA funding that helps them. And so during Crime Victims Rights Week this year, and I would love, you know, in April to link you up with some folks who can really talk about this theme and how important
this
week is. Yeah, the week of April 6th is near and dear to us, and it's the time where we really, really pay attention to crime victims and their needs and their issues and their concerns. And I know you will be focusing. You do it every year, every week of the year, which is a wonderful thing in itself. But during the week of April 6th.
We'd love to form a show around that. I've spoken with Kim Kelberg, but I kind of, the communications people, we kind of miss connections here. So maybe we can get reconnected in order for us to do some shows during that week. I think that would be wonderful. So maybe you can help me with that.
You should come down for, we have the Justice Department has its award ceremony, and then we have a victim caucus in the U.S. Congress that also has a ceremony and meeting in April. So we'll talk afterwards. Maybe you come down.
All right. That definitely sounds cool. And, you know, why don't you tell our audience about your misses and your newsletter that is sent out, because it sounds like such a golden nugget. Is it a weekly publication?
Yeah, I do. For years, it came out of the National Victim Assistance Academy, which is the standardized training for victim advocates across the country. And, you know, we would have like over 100 students in our student body, and they all wanted to stay in touch over the years. So I started a weekly list service called Monday Mentoring Misses. A big part of my work is mentoring the next generation so I can retire someday. And our motto is that we do the work so you don't have to. So I have a lot of people at state and national level who send me resources on funding and research and evidence-based practices. And once a week, I put information out to the field, and I think y'all are both members of it, just to keep everyone informed about what's going on. And if I had to pick a favorite thing about my entire career, it's probably doing this, because it goes out to about 1,500 people, but then get forwarded to several thousand more. And so the outreach is really important just to keep people aware of all the free stuff out there that can help them, you know, be better in criminal justice, be better in victim services. And if you're a survivor, there's good information there just to kind of help you cope with what you're feeling.
You know, that's a great idea. We should actually do a show on all the free stuff, Delilah. What do you think?
Exactly. I think that would be very informative.
I think that would be good.
Oh, my God, we should do like a flea market on victim assistance stuff. There's so much out there, I'm telling you.
Okay, well, we're going to call you on that one. Now, that sounds great. You know, I'm always looking for new ideas. We're about thinking out of the box. And this hour's just flown by. In the last almost minute and a half or so, what would be your parting message, Anne, for tonight's theme that you have done prior to us maybe getting you back in a few months to talk about some other really good things?
I would circle back to where we began, Donna and Delilah, and that is that everyone is or knows a victim of crime, and that there are so many amazing services, both within the justice system, criminal and juvenile justice, but also our community-based programs that are just, you know, ready, willing, and super qualified to help victims. And I just like victims and survivors to know that there is help and hope available for them from these folks who, you know, like y'all, have dedicated their lives to victim assistance. And we are here to help. And do call upon us. I hope your listeners are not ever victimized by crime. In the event they are, there are just wonderful resources available to them.
Can you quickly give us your contact information in case somebody would like to read some of your things or get in touch with you for something?
Yes, my email is annesey@atlantic, atlanteach.net.
Okay. All right. Very good.
And you can put that out on your wonderful blog as well.
We will. We definitely will. Wait and see. It'll be good. So we again, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure. Everyone, I want to say thank you so much for listening. Be sure to listen to the show on the archives and tune in next Saturday for another edition of Shattered Lives. Delilah, thank you so much. And thank you again. We'll talk to you soon. Everyone, be safe. And good evening.
Thank you.
You're welcome.